10,000 guns blazing in the night. So please understand, Jeff Brand, you're a wanted man, shot down by your brother's hand. Jeff Brand, run out of this land. They won't stop till you can.
That was Ghostbusters, and this is Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Today with a smaller crowd, this is Dawn, your philosopher political science student, and...
This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian. And Dawn's right, we do have a smaller crew. Our friend Daniel is off running the Free Thinkers Club, and Elon's gallivanting in Ottawa, and Rob is, well, off in Europe. But don't worry, we'll be hearing from Rob later in this show, so.
And we'll be right back after this message.
The UBC School of Music has jazz, opera, choirs, symphonies, and more. Visit www.music.ubc.ca for listings of free and nearly free musical elixirs to keep you warm all winter long.
Okay, so we have here an email that we got. This was from a couple of weeks ago. We did a show on naturopathic medicine, and we got this email, and I'm going to read a bit of it. It's quite long, so I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I do encourage our listeners to check out our blog at ubcfreethinkers.blogspot.com, where you'll find the whole email and a detailed response. So I'm just going to start by reading it out here. Hey guys, I agree on some of the things you said on today's show about seeking medical help, but I think you have a very biased view on alternative medicine because of maybe you have a science degree background, or maybe your mom was a nurse handing out drug company samples.
You know, sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, that doesn't sound like she's discussing the topic. She's just trying to attack us.
Yeah, that's actually what we call an ad hominem attack, which is when you attack the person and not the argument that they have.
What else does she have to say?
Well, she goes on to talk about homeopathy and makes a strange statement. She says, aspirin might be from willow bark, but compare it to cocaine, it is a cut and processed product. Which I guess she's saying that because both cocaine and aspirin are processed products, they're both bad. Which sounds to me like a non sequitur.
Yeah, no, I mean... There are a lot of natural medicines that have been taken into, you know, in their process. But, I mean, coca, which is unprocessed cocaine, is addictive and it's high. And some natives in South America use it. But, I mean the illicitness of it, or poppy seeds, you know. I mean, the poppy opiate is still there.
Yeah, I don't understand the comparison between over-the-counter drug and pure cocaine, but...
I mean, if you go out in the woods and you pick a mushroom, you know,
yeah,
and you eat it and it turns out to be a death head, is that a natural medicine that just...
I don't know. Maybe. Our writer goes on, anything taken in excessive amounts, whether it be Western or Eastern medicine, can have devastating effects, which is why there are trained people in each practice. You should really research your ideas on naturopathic education. Well, we basically stated this on the show. You can overdose on prescription drugs, and which is, you know, why we have trained pharmacists to inform you not to, to take dangerous drugs.
You can even overdose on water, actually, and that's happened on a few occasions.
Yeah, that's true. And the reason why we made the statement that we think an MD is a bit more better for this type of situation is because an MD goes through years of training to know which drugs can be safely taken, whereas most naturopathic doctors only take non-credited courses, meaning they pay fees and they'll get to call themselves naturopaths.
You know, and that even goes into the whole idea. I mean, the medical establishment, and we'll call it an establishment, and maybe it's not all perfect, but I mean, at least they follow a scientific process. So, I mean, how much of a drug is deadly? Well, they actually go through a scientific evidence test-based system to find out exactly how much can, in theory, kill you. Whereas naturopathy medicine tends to rely on anecdotal evidence, and there's very little systematic investigation, and I've never heard of any that go to the point to find out toxicity levels.
Yeah, it's a very good point. I mean, most medicine that you will pick up at your pharmacist has been through lots of double-blind, science-based studies to find out just how toxic it can be. That's why when you go to your pharmacist, they'll make you sit there for 15 minutes and ask questions like, do you smoke? Do you drink? Do you take this or that or this? Don't take that when you take this. I don't think naturopaths go through that process.
No, and that brings up another interesting thing, and having, because I can read the email here, another thing that she mentioned, she talks about how grapefruit can interfere with cancer treatment, right? And I mean, on the one side, you sit there and say, well, what does that have to do? I mean, how does grapefruit cause cancer or whatever? But there is, if you were a proper scientist and you went through medical training, there are actual drug interactions. There are chemicals in grapefruit that can have effect on some medications. That is taken into account by a proper MD. Whereas the naturopath or homeopath or whatever kind of tends to overlook or not see that as important.
Yeah. That's one of the issues with non-science-based medicine is there's, generally speaking, a lack of extended knowledge about what medicine is safe. So our writer goes on and says, as far as swine flu goes, it's a mixture of human flu, avian flu, and bird flu that could not naturally happen. It is not the swine flu you get in pigs, which means it was created in a lab. So where is the evidence for this?
I smell a conspiracy theory here.
Yeah, well, our knowledge of viral evolution indicates that flu strains mutate and merge like this all the time. It's how we get them. And for one thing, this has been happening for many, many years, long before we even had laboratories where nefarious scientists mixed potent potables to make swine flu. So,
and I mean, if you think as far as economic gains, I mean, again, just republicizing how many people die from normal flu influenza every year, it's like 1,000 times more people die every year from regular seasonal influenza. I mean, if a conspiracy was going to arise, it would arise from something like that instead of
a flu that infects 32 people or something.
And has the overwhelming known as to not to actually hurt people, except for Mexicans. Don't know why that is. I'm sure they'll figure out there's some correlation or causation that makes that a special event.
Probably because of Mexico doesn't have the same health standards as developed countries. Anyway, our writer goes on to say, explaining her last statement, I'm sorry I do not have the time to explain it all, but a little scientific research and you smart boys can figure it out, which is basically special pleading. I don't have to explain myself, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. You make a claim and then you throw the onus on the other person to prove your own claim.
Yeah. And the email goes on mentioning a lot of anti-vaccine propaganda that's been debunked before. And If you check out resources like Science-Based Medicine or What's the Harm, you'll find lots and lots of documentation written by MDs, doctors, who talk about, go through the point by point and can explain to you exactly why it's all
Well, and I know our loyal listeners were listening to our last show where we were talking about how this anti-vaccination claim not only is bad, but, I mean, it kills people. When you deal with things like the polio eradication program that stopped, or the fact that there's a thing called herd immunity, whereas if you have at least, you know, a significant percentage of the population vaccinated,
it needs to be about 95% is the limit.
The infectious disease can't get a hold in the community. But because there's these campaigns against reason seem to be so significant, that's failing. And there are children who are dying. There are reemergings of diseases that were gone before in England and Australia. You know, things like meningitis or
whooping cough.
That's the one I was thinking of.
It's actually quite tragic, and it's a very sad situation, because I just heard of a very tragic story from Australia where a young baby died of whooping cough not because her parents didn't get her immunized. She was too young. Because of herd immunity had gone down so low, there wasn't...
The disease was endemic in the population, and if you're a vulnerable thing like this child was, you get the disease.
Yeah.
You know, it's things like this that almost make me want to think that these people should almost be charged for criminality. I mean, if I sat there and I told you, oh, you can go into that room, it's safe, and that room is full of cyanide gas or something, well, I would be charged for participating in your death. And
yeah, it's a very touchy debate, and probably one we will talk about in a later show about the role of preventing this kind of material. So our email goes on. There is a reason Western medicine discredits homeopathic medicine, traditional Chinese medicine, naturopathic medicine, and other alternatives. Medical doctors can't prescribe these alternative medicines, and no drug companies can profit from it. Well, if you actually check, most natural medicine, and homeopathy for that matter, costs about 75% more than science-based medicine. And further, several drug companies have realized this and are now labeling working scientific medicine natural, or other, you know, code words for meaning it's from the earth, it's wonderful, it's herbal.
Well, yeah, even homeopathic, you know, has become a thing for sleep medications and that kind of thing, right? I mean, I find it funny. I mean, anyone who knows me knows I am not a big fan of big corporations at all, right? Are they
really?
Can they be evil? Definitely. But, I mean, at least the one thing a big pharma can say, I mean, at least they have done scientific research to some degree, and they have actually outlaid money, so there is some justification for the expense of their medicines. Whereas a lot of these things, especially when you start going into homeopathy, where really all you've got is water and perhaps a little voodoo going over top of it, I mean, the profit margin on something like that seems far more exorbitant, far more of a ripoff than you'd get from pharma. Not that they don't do it, but at least they do it in a scientifically and regulated way.
Right. Well, we thank our email writer, and feel free to write back, and we can talk about these claims. And if you want to send us an email and have it read on the air, email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com, and we'll be right back.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hello, and we're back. Now, I hope everyone out there has voted today. If you haven't voted already, there's still plenty of time. Besides electing our illustrious representatives, we also have a referendum out there called the STV vote, or single transferable vote, which is intended to change the way we do our elections. Currently, we have a thing called first past the post, which basically means winner takes all. If you have one more vote than the number two guy, you win, and everyone else gets to throw their votes away, or at least that's what the STV people would say. The STV vote is a little different. The idea behind it is you rank the people who you want to have voted from one to everyone on the list if you want. And there's a specific number of votes you needed in order to get elected. So in a riding like Vancouver, it might be something like 10,000 votes in order to get elected. Once you have 10,000 votes, those people are taken off. And everyone else who's voted for you, their number two choice comes in. And then they find out who has now the top number of votes. He gets taken off. And then we go to number three and so on and so forth until the end.
And there's been a lot of debate about which system is better and which system works best for BC. And we've both been exposed to the commercials and the advertisements for both systems. So what system do we think is the best system for BC when we weigh the pros and cons?
Well, I know one thing from, I mean, this is the second time, as people may notice, around with this referendum. And last time, we had a number of people said yes in the right number of districts, but the overall percentage vote for the province, I think, was like 58%, and it needed to be 60% according to legislation. But yeah, no, I mean, the critics of this, you know, the people who are in favor of it normally point out that this is a form of direct proportionality, but with a slight bit of restraint so as to make your MLAs more accountable. So instead of voting for people for the whole province, you're voting for people just in Vancouver, let's say, right? And there are six MLAs that would be voted for in the next election for Vancouver.
Yeah, and the representatives would come from much larger districts than we have now, and the largest districts like Vancouver would elect up to representatives will elect only maybe three. And the idea being that it would make the representatives more accountable to the people who voted for them, which will remain to be seen if that happens.
Right. Yeah, and again, I mean, one of the things that everyone kind of complains is in some elections, you get situations where you might have 34% of the population voted for Party A. But because of the way they happen to be distributed amongst the province, that party might end up getting 60 or 80% of the actual seats in parliament. And what that means is the other rest of the people, their votes account for nothing. And that's, again, part of what this is intended to address.
Right. We should point out, though, there are a few cons, so to speak, with this system. One that's been brought up before is that this system will produce, more likely than not, minority governments, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But if you like your government to do a lot of actions and a lot of pass lots of legislature, this might not be the best system for that. Assuming, of course, that the parties will actually cooperate and, you know, everyone.
That is the great trade-off here. I mean, on the one sense right now, you can get a party get elected, and if they have a majority in there, anything they want to get done gets done, period. I mean, we have a loyal opposition in our parliamentary system, but really all they can do is they can raise fuss, try and get people mad, but we don't even really have an effective recall mechanism, so there's really nothing. Once they're elected, they have carte blanche until the next election. But with the idea of minority governments, assuming this system brings in minority governments, and I think that's a valid possibility, is instead of forcing through your legislation, you will need to come up with partnerships with other parties. So even if you get a really a party that's in there that has a lot of radical ideas, and they do manage to get the most seats and form a government, they can't actually put forward all of the radical ideas. They have to get agreement from the other ones. It's the difference between a dictatorial form of government versus a consensus form of government. Now, of course, as Ethan has mentioned, there are some downsides to that.
Yeah, and there is an argument to be made that suppose in our system we basically have two main parties, and depending on which party you support, you may not like the idea of your party being in power but not having the majority to get through their choices. So it is a bit of a balancing act. And the other thing we were talking about with forming alliances and working together, it is theoretically possible, and there has been a lot of people saying, you know, a two-party system is not really very fair because it pushes you to either one extreme or the other. If you have a system where you have, say, five different parties in one government, you get far more in-the-middle parties that are not necessarily going to push you to the far right or the far left. It's going to foster a bit more middle road politics, which probably is best for everyone.
I think we've explained the system a lot. I noticed one of the things I think that's interesting and pretty probably important to our things, because this is a skeptic show, is in some of the advertisements, right? There are some things you need to be skeptical for. For example, in some of the campaigns against the STV, they make an interesting claim, and they say, under STV, quote-unquote, in Victoria, candidates will only need 12.5% of the votes in order to get elected, whereas in Dawson Creek, you'll need 33%, or in Prince George, you'll need 35%. Well, if you read that, you'll say, wow, that doesn't sound fair. And they say it doesn't sound fair. But what they're neglecting to tell you, again, you need to bring a skeptical eye, that percentages and numbers can be manipulated, is that in Prince George, there are only three candidates. In Dawson Creek, that district, will only have two candidates, whereas in Victoria, they'll be electing six candidates. It's a one person, one vote. If you believe in democracy, where there are more people, you get more votes. So because they're using a percentage, it sounds like a disparity, but you still need the same number of votes in Victoria as you would in Prince George or Dawson Creek. It's just they have a smaller population to begin with, so it sounds spookier.
Yeah, the population ratio is off in those examples. I mean, it's the same with Vancouver. You wouldn't expect the smallest district to elect six people like Vancouver does, because it's the most populated area of BC. So it's going to naturally have more elected representatives. Even in our current system, if you look at a district map of Vancouver, there's about 20 different tiny districts all across just the Vancouver area. So,
yeah, no, actually. But that's okay. So that's one thing. But of course, the other side's doing the same thing. When you're skeptical, you can't play favorites. So on the other side, the STV people will sit there and they say, well, one, it's going to bring in a more proportional representation. And we've already discussed, it might, but there's no guarantee. When you look at where it is in other parts of the country, and the anti-STV bring out Malta and Ireland, which is where the system are used, you have strong party machines that actually have dominated the whole system and hasn't brought in a greater proportionality. And they also, other things will bring in minorities will have a better chance under this STV system. And that, again, might be true, but there is no direct evidence for that yet. So the one side manipulates a bit of the statistics. The other side kind of makes claims for things that don't actually have evidence. You should always look at anything, politics, science, with a skeptical eye.
Well, the thing, too, with this is you can't really compare two different countries or provinces that use the same voting system, because there are so many different factors. There's historical trends, and there's population, the way people view politics and ideology, and, for example, how far leaning to the right is one country versus one area that's maybe far leaning to the left. So it really doesn't make a lot of sense to compare BC to, you know, Ireland and all that. I think the best system is to look at the pros, look at the cons, be skeptical, and make an informed decision.
Have you voted, Ethan?
Not yet, but I will vote at some point.
I always vote at the advance polls, safer that way. But you remember, everyone out there, to get out and vote, and we'll return after this PSA.
Want to know what's going on around town? LiveMusicVancouver.com is the Lower Mainland's comprehensive source for live music listings. We've got more than 350 shows listed at any time, and our listings are updated continuously by hundreds of the very people who put on the shows you love. Artist information and MP3s are accessible right from the listings, as are maps and calendars for virtually every venue in the city. All this and tons more, totally free, at LiveMusicVancouver.com.
Okay, so now we're going to be talking about ghosts and things that go bump in the night.
I'm so afraid.
So what can you tell us about ghosts, Ethan? Do they exist?
Well, that's what we're going to find out. So we've all been in that situation where we're at home, we're just falling asleep, or maybe just waking up, and all of a sudden we hear this strange sound, or maybe we catch something out of the corner of our eye, or we strange smell, or just a vague feeling that we're in the presence of something else. You guys know what I'm talking about, right?
Occasionally, sure.
I get a strange smell sometimes, but I don't think it's ghosts.
Okay, well, that's disturbing. So, you know, we might want to tell someone about this. And when we tell them, you know, we want to make them believe us. We want to exaggerate a little bit. So maybe a vague feeling becomes, I saw something moving around. And this phenomenon becomes the ghost story. And this is where it all starts.
That plays into the whole psychology that if we have these little bits of data, we need to put it somehow into something we can digest, a narrative, a purpose, a reason, or whatever.
It's true. We're story-making machines. We like taking data and random patterns and making them into something that makes sense. So
if we see something out of the corner of our eye, it wasn't something there. It had to be an object that was moving. It wasn't, you know, there was something that did moving. It wasn't.
Well, yeah, and you're going to tell a story. You want the story to be good. So you're not going to say, I saw something, probably was nothing.
Well, no, actually, and you're even hinting at that. I mean, you make it sound like a story as if people would make it up. But I mean, you want it. You have to describe it to someone. And how do I describe it? Do I say, well, there was this something weird that I can't quite explain that sort of funny happened? No, you put it into language other people can. Say, I saw this object in the corner of my eye, and it looked kind of like a glow or something, and it moved rapidly. And I mean, you might be making a lot of that kind of up, but just to describe something that may be indescribable to you.
Yeah, that's true. It's a lot of it. You're trying to describe a feeling. And so you might say, I felt like I was being watched, or I felt like there was just something moving around right beyond my perception. And that's the ghost part. That's the intangible oogie googie stuff that's going on.
As long as we're talking about seeing these things just before or after you wake up or go to bed, I mean, who's to say you didn't dream the whole thing?
Well, that's the big question. I always ask people who tell me a ghost story, and they say, you know, I was in bed when this happened, or I was just waking up when I heard a strange sound. I say, isn't it more reasonable that you were dreaming? Like, what's more likely the course? There really was a ghost, or you just dreamed it? And I'm sure we can all think of examples when we've had pretty realistic dreams.
Or even this type of thing where you hear a bump in the night or something kind of shifts on a shelf, right?
House creaking at night. Yeah.
Exactly. There's so many things that happen. And, you know, we're in bed where it's dark. You know, we've just woken up and you hear a sound. It's only natural that your alert senses go up and you kind of go, what was that?
Though if you start seeing, say, cutlery flying around and impaling your cat on the wall, then you've got something to worry about.
In that case, I would recommend calling the Ghostbusters.
Well, especially if you find your partner sleeping on top of the sheets, 3 feet on top of the sheets.
Yes, and saying, like, Zool.
There is no Dana, only Zool. But bringing up the Ghostbusters brings up a good point. What about those ghost hunters on TV that go around with these electronic doohickeys looking for hauntings and looking for ghosts? I mean, what's up with that?
I don't even think those people know what they're doing, because the devices they use oftentimes are for typical temperature readings, and they're holding them like they're a tricorder out of Star Trek. It just seems like they're trying to make something out of nothing with those. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they really are exploring hauntings. I don't know.
Well, no, I mean, I've spent a number of years working at a Radio Shack, if anyone remembers what a Radio Shack was, electronic specialty type store. And a lot of the equipment they use, EM meters and all that, right? They're good for detecting a general electrical field in the area. But I mean, in any setting, there's thousands of general electrical light bulbs.
Yeah, what's to say that an electronic, you know, electromagnetic field is evidence of a ghost at all? It's evidence of an electromagnetic field is what it is.
I even find it's really hilarious when you see some of them that are on TV, right? And they've got the shows doing, right? And they've got these little electric field monitors out there, and they say, I detect a field. Well, duh, you got the camera lights on, you got a camera on. Some of their electronic equipment they're using to detect is in itself emitting the same fields that they're supposedly detecting.
And the question is, like what Rob was just saying, how do you detect a ghost? There's no codified reasons or logic behind ghosts. They're all different. Is it a poltergeist? Is it a gremlin? Is it a ghost? Is it a haunting? What? I mean, there's no dictionary of ghosts out there that these people ascribe to.
If we had found ghosts, it would have moved out of the realm of parapsychology into something else. The fact is that we have not found any real evidence of ghosts, because all the evidence that is purported to support the idea of ghosts is just things like electromagnetic fields and noises and unreliable witness testimony.
Or bugs on a camera.
Well, no.
That's a good point. There's all these pictures going around of orbs and, you know, pictures of ghosts that are supposed to be, you know, caught on camera, and they weren't there when you took the picture. I mean, is that really evidence of ghosts, or is it just evidence of something on the camera lens?
Well, and actually, there's been a number of studies that have done where people have replicated those effects. And they're actually effects that are inherent in either the digital digital equipment that you're using that produce these little, they're ghost effects, but it's the ghost in the machine, not the ghost that's outside there.
Yeah, and again, with so many of these camera tricks, you get any kind of professional photographer or anyone who has any knowledge of Photoshop, I personally don't, but even I can tell you when you have the strap of the camera hanging down in front of the lens or your thumb is blocking the flash key. It's pretty common mistakes that
It's almost, I'd be embarrassed to present that as evidence of ghosts.
I think ultimately, though, I mean, what we're all pointing here, that if ghosts were real, I mean, if ghosts really did exist as we think it, there would be far more scientific type evidence of it. And they would pass from the para science into real science, and there isn't. I mean, all these electrical phenomena that are supposed to be ghosts. Well, if you really think they exist and these are real things, you can proof your house against ghosts by just making sure your house is well grounded, and all those electrical discharges will just disappear into the earth.
Well, that's a pretty good idea. I mean, I'm surprised that some ghost hunting company hasn't offered to ghost-proof your house at this point.
Oh, I'm sure they're out there. I'm sure they're out there.
Well, if you do find any ghosts in your house, or at least think you do, who are you going to call? Not the Ghostbusters. Call a skeptic first.
That's great.
Free thinkers. Woo-hoo!
Yes, call us. Well,
reasonable rates. And we'll be right back after this message.
Okay, hello. I'm Tim, again, Stereolab, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
Okay, we've reached the end of the show. Don, give us a quote.
I've got a great quote here today. Facts are meaningless. You could use facts to prove anything that's even remotely true. Homer Simpson.
Oh, that is so well said. So, we remind our listeners to download our podcast at www.citr.ca or on iTunes. Email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. And check out our blog at ubcfreethinkers.blogspot.com.
This is Don saying eyes open, brains on.
And this is Ethan, the freethinking historian, saying good night.
I'm going to be around my vegetables, I'm gonna chop down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub. It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies. It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce. It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems. Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply. Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
I walk 400 miles through valleys and the woods, if only to make good on this promise I made to a girl that I met down at the park. Her hair ran in 5 different directions. She asked me to follow the first morning's light, so I could absorb me throughout the winter. So I'm climbing this hill to get the right angle to capture the light as it breaks over the horizon. Holding up this empty bottle, soda I drank on the way. I'll cap the lid on real tight.